You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Janet Ellis, and this is Twice Upon a Time, where each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy. This is a podcast to celebrate that magical book which cast a spell over us and often still has us in its thrall. My guest is the actor Tuppence Middleton. She recently starred in the Oscar-nominated film Mank as Sarah Mankiewicz, opposite Gary Oldman, and she was called the naughtiest woman on TV for her portrayal of Russian princess Elena Karagina in the television adaptation of War and Peace. Tuppence Middleton, welcome to Twice Upon a Time, and thank you very much for your choice of book, which I think will be on a lot of people's bookshelves and in their hearts. What did you choose?
I chose Stick of the Dump by Clive King.
Why? What was your first reason for going back to that one straight away?
Yeah, it was actually a really hard decision to pick a book. Firstly, because I wasn't a huge reader as a child. I think I became a much bigger reader sort of 18 onwards when I left home. We would always have children's book around the house and, you know, we read a lot at school, but there wasn't that kind of middle period, I think, sort of from maybe 11 to late teens. I didn't read that much at all, really. I don't know why. I think it was something about, it fell in that category for me of things that I have to do, therefore I don't want to do, like piano lessons, you know, which I loved playing the piano, but I hated practicing. So it felt that there was always this pressure to do it. And then I realized, obviously, at 18, how silly I was and how much I loved reading. And then I kind of caught up over several years. But in choosing a children's book, Stick of the Dump was the first thing that I remember reading the whole way through for school and really enjoying it. Kind of ignited my passion for reading kind of longer children's books.
How old were you when you read it?
Well, I was in year three. I don't know if it's still organised like that now in schools, but that was so age seven.
Yeah,
7 to 8. And it was also the first time, it was the start of proper school, and it was the first time I had a form tutor who I really loved. It was this woman called Mrs. Nib, and I always really remember that because she would write it up on the blackboard, Mrs. Nib spelt with a K, and she would always write Mrs. Knib, Knows, Knothing, so that we remember that her name was said Nib, not Knib. And she was so lovely, so kind. And she had such passion for this book. She would always read sections out loud and made everything about it so fun. There was always exercises and always little projects around the book. So it was the first time that a book really came alive for me.
Did you have a copy at home too?
No, we had them at school. I think they probably didn't trust us to, number one, look after them and not lose them. So, no, we used to keep them in school on a little bookshelf. And there was, you know, I don't know how many of the... There wasn't a class, probably maybe 10, 15 or something. And there was just, 10 identical little copies on the bookshelf. And you'd go up and you'd have your name inside and you'd go and pick them from the shelf and sit around on, you know, they would always push all the desks to the side of the classroom and sit around on these kind of big cushions when we had reading time.
And Mrs. Nib aside, what was it that made you love the book?
Well, I think... It's funny because I obviously reread it before talking to you. I sort of found some of it actually reading it back. The first couple of chapters, in a way, quite boring because it's just this little boy, you know, finding this man who lives in the dump in the chalk pit at the end of his grandma's garden. and collects old things. And so much of it is just, you know, this caveman finding uses for everyday objects, or someone loses something, or they think they hear someone outside. And it's so long and drawn out that I thought, well, I can't remember why I loved this so much. And then later on in the book, it becomes much more of an adventure. But it also reminded me of that feeling, all these little things that you do, whether it's going out and climbing a tree or making a mud pie, which we used to do a lot when we were little. And this also has that sort of spirit. Then everything feels so big, you know.
And boredom, I mean, there are several themes in the book. Boredom is definitely one of them. Just constructing your world from very little, really. I mean, and the freedom, of course, that Barney and his sister have to just go at the beginning of the day and come back at the end, and nobody really minds about what you've been doing in the middle.
Yeah.
Did you have that sort of freedom as a child?
You know, I think I did, because I remember we lived on a little cul-de-sac, and two of our best friends, who were the children of one of my mum's best friends growing up, lived just across the road. And so we would shout to my mum, we were going out to play, and then we'd come back a couple of hours later. And we'd often go around the corner. There was actually, not dissimilar to the dump, there was just this sort of barren area where there just seemed to be lots of piles of vegetation, because we were always there looking for slow worms. We were obsessed with slow worms. Used to take the washing up bowl from the sink, come back with, I don't know, two or three slow worms, which my mum had to house for however many days. And then we were told to take them back. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, all sorts of things, bringing salamanders home from school and trying to tap the floor so lots of slugs would come up. There was always a little project, and so much of it was out in nature, which...
Barney gets into what were called scrapes, I think. You know, he was actually climbing things he shouldn't and falling off things. And in fact, he only discovers Stig because he falls what would probably look to his mother quite a long way.
A long way. And he's also playing in a dump with several things which are probably rusty and dirty, and there's, you know, all sorts there. You know, that it certainly feels like... Now that would be something people would be very anxious about.
Yeah.
But, it felt so much a part of our childhood, you know, being outside. And
well, there's also so much more fear around children being alone now, which certainly when I was a child, it didn't happen. I mean, we did live near a chalk pit, and my sister and I used to just go there.
Yeah.
Looking at it now, I think, well, we did survive. Of course we did. But it was extraordinarily liberating. But the weird thing is with Barney, the little boy at the centre of this story, who is staying with his grandmother, as you say, and then finds Stig, this potentially Stone Age man, being in the dump and repurposing things brilliantly, is that Barney is actually still, he still brings the adult world with him. And certainly I hadn't read it since I was a child. So, and you get that very different perspective naturally when you're not 8 years old anymore.
Yeah.
But he actually, although he's aware that he can... let rules go when he's away from his grandma.
Yeah.
He still sticks to them, doesn't he? He still observes the world in this sort of quasi-adult way, which is really sweet.
Yeah, I think that also feels very true to the time. That sort of, there's this sort of politeness or something. It feels quite period, you know, in the way that it's written, that he's sort of, he's a good boy and he obeys by the rules, and he says he's going to go out, but he's always back in time for dinner. And actually, he's really lovely to this man. And it was really funny doing a bit of research on Clive King. I read that he, over the course of his life and career, had tried to learn 10 languages, which is totally bonkers and amazing. But he never quite mastered any of them. I think it, in fact, says in the foreword. But it makes sense to me that so much of the book is about communication, about...
And Stig has no language at all.
No language at all.
So it's a completely nonverbal communication with him, which is part of the joy of it, really, isn't it? And Barney is unafraid of him almost from the word go, too. Whatever that is, he senses benevolence and absolutely no threat, despite the fact he looks like nobody and lives like nobody he's ever seen before. It's quite sweet, because when he's looking at it, he says something like, you know, this place has never been given a tidy up. You know,
so sweet. Such like mother says that.
And he asks him for a clothes brush at one point, you know, because he's going back home and he needs to tidy himself up.
I know.
But their relationship starts at a very particular level, doesn't it? They don't build up. And is it partly because, I wonder, because Barney is creating Stig for himself, or is it because Stig represents a very unthreatening adult world into which he is completely immediately welcome?
I think both of those things are true. And I think also on top of that, in a way, it's kind of how children approach friendship, I think. That it felt so familiar to me to read that he meets this person and immediately he's his best friend. It's so important when you're that age, isn't it? Who your best friend is, who your closest friends are, and who you're going to play with at lunch. And I remember, oh God, just having nightmares about break time at school and thinking, well, who am I going to play with? And will this person play with me today? And but I really want to play with that person. And it's huge. It's a huge part of your world is making friends. And those friends become massively influential. So it felt kind of true to form that happened. And even when the Snarget boys, who are a group of kind of naughty boys from the neighbourhood, find the dump and Barney sort of walks in on them and they have a bit of an altercation before eventually, you know, they end up respecting him and his friendship with Stig and Stig himself, but and slightly fearing him. Even then, he's so willing to forgive their initial sort of bullying behaviour and then think, oh, they're all right, really.
And later on with spoiler alert here, folks, with the burglars later, you know, he thinks, oh, they're carrying some spoons because somebody might need a spoon.
Yes.
You know, not that they might have been stolen.
No.
He's a real innocent abroad.
Yes, and they told him that, so he believes it. And that's so, you know, that's also so childlike, isn't it, to, you know, everything that adults say is gospel, so it must be true. Adults don't tell lies. And it's so... I think it's such a wonderful exploration of childhood because he's so innocent and pure and good, you know, which not all children are all the time. But it's as a child, it's so lovely to read that, and it's kind of like a, you know, maybe not so subtle example to kids reading.
Well, I really enjoyed the relationships too with his grandmother and his sister. Both of whom are forming this little group who do things together, like going shopping.
Yeah.
I was particularly thrilled at the reference to Sevenoaks.
Yeah.
One of my many schools was in Sevenoaks, so I raised a small flag there. But also the relationship with his sister is very sweet, because although for a lot of the book, 7/8 of the book, she is not part of the story for him and Stig at all, she's not dismissive. You know, he comes back and says what's happened, and he found this man and he lives like this, and, you know, he's repurposing things in the chalk pit and he's Stone Age potentially.
Yeah.
And both the grandmother and his sister Lou kind of go, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yes,
so they don't actually rubbish it at all.
No, fully accepting of it. And there is also that thing which made me think of my brother, actually, because I'm one of three and my brother is the youngest and my sister and I are slightly closer in age. So, you know, when you're growing up, he's the one who gets the short straw and is dressed up in dresses and ribbons and makeup, and we
this
practice all
my
of our
son
things.
Too,
yeah, it's just part of the deal, which he took very well. But I can imagine being, you know, a little boy in a very female household, or vice versa, that then sometimes you need to go off and play in the dump with your friend Stig, you know.
This book has never been out of print, so it just shows you it's over 50 years old now and it's never been out of print. So there's obviously something in it about friendship and childhood and who you are allowed to be and who you want to be and who other people are to you resonates massively right down the generations.
Yeah, I think so. And reading it again, I think there are so many valid things that apply now, you know, about repurposing things and, you know, recycling and, you know, not taking things for granted, that, you know, I can take this thing and actually I can use it in a different way and I don't have to be wasteful. And all of these things that he finds in the dump are magic in their own way. They have a use and he doesn't consider them rubbish because he sees that Stig uses them as part of his life and his home. And so I think that you know, alongside him kind of communicating with this man that he doesn't share a language with. It's so, I mean, I feel, you know, once every 2 or 3 weeks, I just get so sad about Brexit still. And I think that it's such a nice thing to read about these two people who find a common ground, you know, despite being from very different walks of life.
Yes, they understand each other straight away, don't they? And it's interesting because, as you say, there's all sorts of things in the dump that Barney thinks he half recognises, possibly the tail of a plane, although he then realises it's nothing quite as exciting. But he sees what he thinks is a bicycle. And just as a throwaway line, Clive King said they didn't let him have a bicycle.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's never referred to again. But it's just really odd, isn't it, that that was so particular. I wonder why particularly that he didn't have a bicycle and he was therefore prepared to just dig one out of the ground pretty much and repair it.
That's very true. I think also at that age, a bike is, I mean, it's like getting your first car. It's such an exciting
thing.
It's huge. I mean, choosing the right bike, choosing the colour, you know, do I want a mountain bike?
Always too big for you as well, isn't it?
It's always too big for you. I mean, you can never ride properly and it's just so exciting. Do you want a basket? Are you going to get stickers? It's so big. And I think that maybe there was something in that, you know, because I'm trying to think. I mean, I'm assuming he was the same age as I was when I read it, which is 7, but I don't...
Yeah, I think he's eight.
So I'm... Yeah, I suppose you do have little bikes before that, but when you get your first kind of proper bike...
Absolutely, no stabilisers. Nobody grabbing the back of the saddle and propelling you slightly too fast.
It's that one thing that, you know, children... Yes. It's like it's on the Christmas list and it's...
I'm thinking of age. I mean, I don't... Does it say... I'm thinking now, I don't know whether it says his age or whether that's just the sort of empirical information around the book.
Mm.
But when he looks at Stig, he has no idea how old he is. And he thinks he could be anything from sort of what he thinks of as really old, like 50. Or thousands.
And it's, and in a way, it sort of doesn't matter because, you know, he's able to find something that what he maybe lacks in age or experience, then he can make up for in language and kind of know-how and a slightly more modern way of life that he, you know, the things that he can teach Stig or that he can give to Stig. And I really love that when he's bringing him presents and things. And I think also it's really nice that in the end, towards the end, you know, it's sort of Stig that brings him and his sister Lou together. Because although you don't feel that she's ever being dismissive or anything like that, you do feel there's a slight separation in their lives. She's doing things with grandma or... And while Barney goes to the dump, or just the fact that, you know, she's a bit older and she's a girl, and suddenly they kind of bond over Stig. And actually, one of my favourite moments in the book later on is, spoiler, when they find a kind of community of Stigs, as it were, and they are welcomed as special guests and they have to give a speech, and Barney's too nervous to do it, so he asks Lou to do it. And she gives this amazing speech, which is a kind of mashup of lots of famous speeches.
It's wonderful. That,
sort of
it?
Works,
it's
really works.
School debating society bit.
And totally.
Things off the telly.
And that really made me giggle.
I made a note of that because I just thought that's exactly what you do as a child. You feel full of the importance of it.
Yeah.
But you're not quite sure. And there's a bit of Christmas is coming. And,
yes. Yeah.
And some Shakespeare.
Shakespeare. Yeah. It was that really made me laugh.
And he's really good, isn't he, Clive King, on the sort of detail of that particular childhood. And, you know, when Barney's waking up in his grandmother's icy room and he can feel his nose cold, and I thought, yep, I remember that only too well.
Oh yeah, my mum always used to tell me, you don't know how lucky you are, we used to have ice on the eiderdown, and, you know, like that it was incredible. And then, you know, it sort of reminds me, I mean, it was, I suppose, a similar time anyway, that I was watching things like The Snowman, and you see that same thing, you know, him kind of waking up and everything being really cold and having to wear socks and a hat in bed. And it feels, I mean, in a sense, that sort of very childlike animation that is in The Snowman. Also, the illustrator, I'm probably going to say his name wrong, Edward
Ardizzone.
Ardizzone.
I think I'm guessing his.
Yes, that sounds right. Edward
Ardizzone. I'll produce him to correct us. So that will have to stand. Sorry, Edward.
But thank you, Edward, because very beautiful illustrations throughout the book. And that was exactly the addition that I remember. These kind of almost like etchings, kind of pencil scratches, and they're so full of life but so simple.
He gets an amazing amount of detail, doesn't he? I'm opening the book now just to sort of light on one, because they have enormous warmth, which sounds strange because they're just black and white, but they have a real depth to them. I think I would happily have any one of these on my wall. They're full of detail and affection and a kind of... It isn't a lost world, this. It doesn't feel like he's drawing something which we think, well, I can't relate to at all.
Yeah.
And particularly, as you say, the ones at the end when they find the sort of Stig community.
Yeah.
Is really affectionate and very generous. And
And so simple. I mean, some of them are very dark, the drawings. I mean, they do, it does look like they could be etchings.
They're so recognisable instantly too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Quite apart from the text, they really take you back.
Yeah.
It's funny reading it now, though, that I sort of thought, and this is going to sound like heresy, but I almost thought he has to kind of shoehorn plot in, because actually there's not much.
Yeah.
And what is there comes and goes quite rapidly, you know, the incident with the boys. You, in another book, would take up, you know, a sort of Jaws theme-like terrible sort of threat to start with, and then they'd appear and they'd be much worse than he thought they were. But actually, it's resolved, thanks to Stig, quite quickly.
Yeah.
And again, the bit with his grandmother's burglars, you know, that happens really quite quickly. And it's almost as though Clive King thought, I'll put some in because there may be some kids who need a bit more to the story.
Yeah.
But actually, if you took both those things out, you would still have an amazing tale. They're not necessary. They're quite lightly done. And the boys, I mean, there's a lovely line about, you know, they're the sort of boys who always get into trouble, but then who doesn't, thinks Barney, you know, because he's not quite sure, I'm sure, what getting into trouble means at that age. You know, they're both still walking around, all three of them are still walking around, and nobody's actually behind bars.
Yeah. But it is so funny, isn't it, that kind of how dramatic those moments are, even though they are short-lived. Everything is so dramatic when you're that age, and it's so huge. And that sort of felt very like, oh, of course there are burglars, and then they go, and they're very quickly, you know, the car is kind of rolled into the pit, and then they cover it over. And I just thought, God, that seems like an awful lot of cover up, and it seems very quickly resolved by the police and the grandma.
That's what I mean. Yes,
it's all
the plot is kind of, all right, that's done.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, and so it feels. Yeah, I think that all of the other things that, all those little moments where not much is happening, which I found slightly more of a struggle to get through as an adult, I think are still so exciting when you're that age. And I remember when we were reading it with Mrs. Nibb, and she would obviously be finding things for us to talk about and finding things for us to do in the classes. And one of those things was bringing in something from home that is rubbish and using it to make something that's useful around the house. And so we had this little project, and I remember, you know, fretting about it for a week, trying to find the right thing and speaking to my parents about it. And then eventually we used an old cereal box, and I don't really know why. I think it's because there was a fox in the book, but we made a hole in the side of the cereal box and made this kind of gummy ridge. I'm not really sure out of what, like kind of cotton wool and something. I don't know what we put inside the cotton wool, but we stuck it around with sellotape around the inside, and used some of the rest of the cardboard from the top of the box to make sort of soft teeth, which we put inside of the circle. And I think, if I can remember rightly, the idea was that if a fox wanted to steal some of the food that was in this box, it would pop its head through the hole, and then it couldn't take its head back out because the teeth would stop it from coming out, which seems actually quite cruel now looking back on it. But I don't think it was designed to kill the fox. It was just designed to sort of to catch it.
It's a deterrent.
Yeah, it's a deterrent. So that was what we decided to make, which seems strange now, but I think we just panicked and thought, well, there's a fox in the book.
Well, the description works perfectly well. Actually, the grandmother in the book apparently was based on Clive King's mother, who was very practical and did save things, because after all, she supplies all the jars that he makes the window from. And,
yes.
And there is one line about, you know, Barney already had a tin opener in his pocket, and that's never quite explained, but it's, you know, in those days, it wasn't just a little gadget. It was a mighty thing. I remember that, you know, and you had to open it up and then clamp it onto the tin.
Yeah.
But he goes around doing that too, of course, to help Stig's current problem with the water leakage.
Yeah.
But all that kind of thing, you know, you thought, yes, like your fox box.
Yeah.
It just seems, you know, the fact that it was actually technically made of cardboard, you know, so the fox would not have been troubled, I think.
No, he wouldn't have been hurt. No.
But, you know, there is something about, you know, that thing of organizing your world and wanting things in it to work for you when you just arrive into it as a tiny helpless person with no idea of how things work or when you'll be able to effectively, you know, get on your bigger bike, you know, cycle off and explore.
Yeah. And I think that those objects, those found objects, are kind of treasure at that age. And I think, you know, it's probably no coincidence I ended up choosing a cereal box, because I remember making a dog out of a cereal box, which I had on a lead. You know, a cereal box turned inside out. And I didn't throw it away for years. And my mum wouldn't throw it away. It was kind of in the attic for a long time after it should have been. Because she was like, I don't want to throw the dog away. And I was like, well, eventually you're going to have to, because it's just a cereal box with some eyes painted on it.
But
it's
so,
I loved it so much, that dog. So,
Do you think, there's only one way to ask this question. Is Stig real? Is he an imaginary friend? Does it matter? Is he...
I always when I read it as a child, I always assumed he was totally real, which I suppose most children do. And I felt that, you know, Grandma and Lou were being silly when they didn't understand that he existed and all of the things he kind of helped him with. And then I was sort of disappointed to read it again as an adult and think, oh, I don't know if he is. I think he might be imaginary. And I think it's that power of imagination you have at that age. You can play with anyone and they don't always have to be there or don't have to exist. And I remember having I think all kids do, but such a strong imagination and being able to just dream the day away. And especially towards the end where there is almost this kind of dream sequence with him and his sister Lou. And you start to think, oh, perhaps
it's
it wasn't
so powerful,
real.
That, isn't it? And yeah. The fact that there's really no build-up to that.
No.
They just suddenly are there.
Yeah.
Watching what sounds like almost the construction of Stonehenge.
Yes, yeah.
And wanting to join in a bit because they realise it will work quicker with wheels, which haven't been invented yet.
Yeah.
But realising that the power of that group and the song they're all singing, which is the wordless song, which has a beat and a rhythm and a bit of a percussion, but everybody knows it. And
yeah.
Barney realises the power of the group.
Yes, yeah.
Did you have, I've committed the crime of positing the fact that Stig did not exist, but did you have an imaginary friend?
I don't think I did, actually. Because I had a sister and a brother around the house all the time, then I felt like actually I sort of did the opposite and went to my room and sat by myself quite a lot because there was always quite a lot of people around. Our house was, you know, always full of people and we're close with my extended family. So there was always people in and out. And because we had our sort of best friends living across the road, there was very easy access to being able to play all the time. And I was social as a child, but I really, really liked my own company. And I think that so much of that was because I was in my head quite a lot, quite sort of dreamy child. So I like to just sit in my room and think and make up, you know, stories in my head. So I felt like I didn't really need an imaginary friend, actually.
Do you ever write those stories down now? Would you write for children?
Oh, God. I would love to at some point. I always had a real weakness for those sort of stories that are almost like rhyming poems. I used to love those when I was younger and my dad was always writing little poems and every Easter and Christmas, he would write rhyming poems. On Easter, he would write clues in rhyming couplets to take us to the next Easter egg or whatever was hidden, little chick or something. I always had kind of a weakness for those stories that were told and a slightly obsessive preoccupation with getting the exact rhythm of something. I think maybe that was also because later on, when you're reading Shakespeare, you know, as an actor, you're so precise about that, about, you know, each syllable counts. So, yeah, I think that maybe one day.
Do you crave solitude now?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I luckily I have quite a lot of it. I sort of live with my cat and on and off, you know, when I'm not working. And I've like, as soon as I could possibly afford to, when I left drama school, I lived by myself just because I've always really liked it. Even though I love to be around people and I love to talk and I don't feel like it's that I need to be on my own. It's just that's where I recharge.
Also a film set, you know, it's an amazing thing.
Yes.
First of all, you're with a bunch of really happy people because everyone's employed.
Yes.
And also they're all engaged on the project.
Yes.
But your relationships go through an arc in 3 or 4 weeks that take most people, I think, 3 or 4 years to
yes.
achieve.
Absolutely. And also there's that sort of feeling, which is good and bad in parts. I think that every job you do is almost like first day at school. So you think, oh God, where do I sit at lunch? Who do I talk to? Who's going to be my friend? But then at the same time, then you make these friends, which, you know, more often than not, there might be one or two people on every job that you take with you throughout life. And maybe you see more of each other 1 year and less of each other the next year. But you do make these kind of lasting friendships, which are very intimate. And so I think you don't have the same worry about, okay, so I'm moving through my life and every decade things change and I change as a person and will these people still be, you know, in my life and will they still live near me? Will they still be my close friends? And I think that you don't have that fear as an actor because you're constantly surrounded by people of all generations and you
yeah.
can relate to them. And so your world is very, very broad in a way that I feel very lucky to experience.
Such a privilege, isn't it?
Yeah.
Put like that, it just sounds heaven.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You can forget about the bits when you're not working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then that means, yeah, then you can have that time and, you know, do all the things that you plan to do when you're working and you're busy and then never actually quite achieve when you're by yourself, but that you have the best laid plans to do.
Actually, the dump's filling up fast now and Stig may be on the move. One report was that he'd been seen working in a garage by the main road where they collect old wrecked cars and put the pieces in rusty piles. And somebody else said they saw him in a back lane of the woody country at the top of the downs, mending a chicken run with an old wire mattress. It certainly sounded like Barney's friend Stig, but perhaps it was only a relative of his. Just to return to the end of the book, which I actually, I'd forgotten how moving it was. I don't think I got it as a child.
No. He's talking about the fact that he thinks he may be sees Stig sometimes as he's getting older, or he sees someone who could be a relative of Stig's. And that's kind of a lovely idea in terms of humanity in general and you know, how we're all connected, but also that feeling of those memories you have as a child are unlike any other memories and they really last and they're so strong, and how you can sometimes see something or someone and it just takes you right back. And again, that's a feeling that you just don't appreciate so much reading it when you're small.
No, it's so true. That feeling of, you know what it is you've lost. Mm-hmm. You cannot possibly get back to it really because it was of its time. Mm. But it's in you.
Yeah.
It's right inside you.
Yeah. And I think it's that thing that I certainly have had, and I think that lots of children go through that. It's the first time you move from the childhood house that you really remember. Awful. It's so traumatic. You leave behind all of these memories of the places that you played, at the garden that you were used to kick footballs into, the neighbors even, you know, that all of these things. I remember so vividly all of our childhood neighbors and all of the houses and the parks, and you have to, it's your first sort of acceptance of loss in a way. You have to accept that you can no longer have these things, that life moves on, that there are greater things around the corner, but also that you have to say goodbye to those friends and to that particular way of life. And that's really hard. And I think that the book does that really beautifully. It kind of describes that callback, those memories that resurface every now and then when you think about something or someone or an event in your life, and that sort of final line where he talks about thinking that he sometimes sees Stig, that I found it really moving.
That is a perfect place to leave it. It's almost that image hovers just slightly somewhere in an almost reachable way.
Mm.
Thank you so much for bringing the book back to us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. This has been Twice Upon a Time with me, Janet Ellis. My guest was Tuppence Middleton. The producer is Caroline Raphael. Recording and post-production by John Wakefield and Diggory Waite. All the titles mentioned are on the podcast show page. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Twice Upon a Pod for pictures of our guests and their brilliant books. And if you like the show, do recommend to a friend or leave us a review. The executive producer is Claire Broughton, and Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.